Hello, hello, this is Harry, and welcome to another episode of A Too Easy. I have Sally here with me.
Hi everyone, it's good to be back. So, Harry, here we're talking about meningitis.
Yep, so meningitis, as always, it's an itis, which strictly means inflammation of something. So it's the inflammation of the meninges inside the skull.
And it's been a while, so just remind me, what exactly do you mean by meninges?
Well, technically there's three of them. And as you might remember from med school, Ben came up with this really odd way of remembering the layers, which was called BDASP. So I don't know why this stuck in my head for the entire 6 years, but you can remember all the layers of the skull from the skin all the way down to the pia mater just by chance via the acronym of SCALP, BDASP. So it's a complete list.
Wow, I can't believe I almost forgot SCALP, BDASP. Like, yes. No, but please do enlighten us. Exactly what do you mean?
So, given it's a full list, I'll just rattle from superficial to deep. So, skin, connective tissue, aponeurosis, loose alveolar tissue, that's a babble, but who cares, periosteum, which spells scalp, and that's the more commonly known part, and then the bit my friend Ben came up with was bone, dura mater, arachnoid mater, subarachnoid space, and then the pia mater, which sits on top of the actual cortical tissue in the brain itself.
So the meninges are essentially formed of the dura mater, the arachnoid mater, and the pia mater, right? So given meningitis is inflammation of all of those layers, what can cause that kind of inflammation?
In short, lots of things. So first off, we could say that meningitis is mostly caused by infections. The rest is all fairly small print and not really worth covering here because you really want to rule out an infective cause first. So Sally, could you please name me some types of infection? We'll keep it broad.
Okay, oh gosh, such like a ward round situation. Types of infections include viral, bacterial and fungal to start with.
Nice. And also you could include specifically TB, which is, yes, it's a bacterium, but it's a mycobacterium. And that makes up the four main types of infective meningitis.
I would definitely say that TB comes under bacteria. But I mean, this is your podcast, Harry, so I'm going to let that slide.
Okay, so if you are being pedantic, which let's face it, you and I mostly are, then yes, fine. In terms of diagnosing them, which we'll come to later, it's actually quite helpful to separate TB from other types of bacteria for this kind of thing.
Fine, so viral, bacterial, fungal and TB, do we need to know like any particular types of viruses, for example?
Yeah, so this is strictly in the kind of be aware of category rather than learning them all off by heart. So I'm going to list off some organisms and then you're going to get depressed that you asked me this question. So I would just like to preemptively apologise for pronouncing at least some of these wrong. So with viral causes, it's easiest to think of them in broad groups. Enteroviruses are the most common cause of organism. Key examples of that include Coxsackie virus and polio. I'll be honest, I never really learned anything about polio at medical school because, well, thankfully we don't see it anymore. So this is just a side fact. Polio was such an important disease previously because it caused meningitis and paralysis. And at one point, it was the most common cause of paralysis in children. Now, instead of polio, it's all the other enteroviruses. The other main group alongside the enteroviruses is the herpes viridae, which is a great name of a thing. HSV-1, 2, and varicella zoster, which is human herpes virus 4, if you're particularly wanting to know. Those are your main sort of culprits there. Then the others I couldn't easily shoehorn in are mumps and HIV.
Okay, fair. I guess with polio, it might become topical again. What with the, is it an inactivated form found in sewage in London? I think there was like a vaccination scheme for children, wasn't there? But anyway, I guess...
I don't know. I don't live in London anymore.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. Okay, guys. So there has been a new strain found in sewage in London. And I believe that a certain age group of children have all been asked to be vaccinated against polio.
But nobody panic.
I don't know any more details than that. So let's move on quickly. So Harry, I guess my question is, how many of these viruses do we really need to know?
Probably none. If you knew that enterovirus is the most common cause, that would be good. That'd be enough. And HIV is almost always a right answer for a thing whenever anyone asks you about a viral cause of something.
Excellent. So on the ward round, viral meningitis, think enterovirus. What about a bacterial?
So bacterial meningitis is generally considered more severe and it's probably worth knowing more about, and particularly knowing more about the common organisms. In adults, the main causative organisms are Neisseria meningitidis, Streptococcus pneumoniae, and to a less extent, Haemophilus influenzae. Neisseria specifically causes so-called meningococcal disease, which is particularly lethal. when you come to learning about neonates and paediatrics, you will learn there are a few other organisms to be aware of, including Listeria.
Gosh, okay. I kind of wish I hadn't asked now, to be honest. But thanks, Harry. That's a good overview of all the bacterial causes. So what about fungal, right? That was the third category?
Yeah. So leaving TB alone for a second, fungal, the main cause is cryptococcal meningitis. It's caused by Cryptococcus neoformans is the predominant cause.
Okay, so putting it all together, we've got enteroviruses, we've got Neisseria, we've got strep pneumo, we've got Haemophilus, Listeria, TB in brackets, and Cryptococcus, right?
Yep, and that's a pretty comprehensive list that you'd do really well if you just knew.
Great. So now that we know probably far too much about what's causing it, who gets meningitis? Who should we suspect it in?
Fine, and we'll come back to all the reasons why I bothered to mention all those names later, but the key thing to know about meningitis is it happens at any age. The main bacterial cause tends to vary by age. Hopefully you will have noticed that a lot of the organisms I've mentioned, polio, mumps, Haemophilus, meningococcus, all have vaccines given in early childhood, as we mentioned with this whole sewage thing. That is because meningitis is more common in young children, with a notable peak during early adulthood as well. Like any infection, it's also more prevalent in crowded places, including educational centres and impoverished areas. Meningitis, generally speaking, has a worse prognosis the older you are, though.
So it's more common when you're young, but often more severe when you're old. So given we know that it can be a life-threatening infection, how does it present?
So there's a fairly classical presentation, which includes a group of features which are termed meningism. Meningism suggests irritation of the meninges, but it's not actually specific for meningitis, annoyingly. Subarachnoid hemorrhage, for example, also causes this, because blood in the subarachnoid space between the arachnoid and pia mater, because remember, scalp and asp, will also cause irritation to the meninges.
So what is meningism exactly?
It's a triad of headache, neck stiffness, and photophobia. Headache is obviously a symptom, but clinically you should treat neck stiffness and photophobia as signs and not symptoms. That's important. AKA, someone saying to you that they have a stiff neck and don't like looking at some lights when they have a headache is not guaranteed meningism, okay? You should examine to see if that is, in your opinion, the case. When taking a history and exploring the headache, a key question to ask about is whether this has happened before. This can help you, as realistically, someone with meningitis has not had it once every 2 weeks for 2 years, for example.
So given you've already said that meningism is not specific, what other features do we need to look out for that actually points towards meningitis exactly?
So since it's caused by an infection, fever, nausea and vomiting are also really common. Then the other key symptom you never want to miss is the rash.
Okay, describe the rash.
It's a non-blanching erythema. This is why everyone, when examining a rash, without even really thinking about it, just pokes it. If you press your finger onto... Yeah, I know, it's weird, right? If you press your finger onto a rash normally, that compresses the blood vessels at the area, and that squeezes the blood away, causing it to go white, aka blanch. When you let go, the blood returns, and the erythema quickly returns as well. In meningococcal disease... infection caused by Neisseria meningitis can cause a petechial rash, where the blood vessels around the area are leaking and bursting, which is one way to exit a vessel, right? When you press, the blood can't flow back up the vessel because it's actually outside of it because it's already flowed out. So it's a non-blanching rash. It's a worrisome sign, which is why we recommend people checking using a clear glass pressed against the skin. To be honest, the rash is usually a late sign in terms of disease progression and often spreads really rapidly. So naturally, if you see it on examination, this is a huge red flag and requires immediate escalation to the senior in charge.
So rash is a late sign. Any other early signs that we should be aware of?
Well, in children, being peripherally shut down is often one of the most first insidious sort of signs. So examination is really key in those patients.
And does the presenting features of the meningitis change depending on whether it's like a viral or a bacterial cause?
In short, yes. So there are sort of stereotypes. Viral often presents with fever and meningism, but without evidence of sepsis. Viral is generally less severe than bacterial. Then there's meningococcal disease, which can present as either a predominantly septic or a predominantly meningitic meningism type picture, or a mixture of the two. And that's the one that classically may have a non-blanching rash. Pneumococcal meningitis is often seen with coexisting pneumonia, which makes sense because it sounds similar, right? And then there's TB meningitis and cryptococcal meningitis, which tend to be subacute in their presentation.
Okay. No, that's really helpful to kind of like, yeah, differentiate them a little bit.
Yeah, this is why I bothered to mention them all earlier, because they all present slightly differently.
Yeah, definitely. And then I guess when you say severe infection, though, what do you mean? What exactly is the kind of prognosis in these patients?
Well, at late stages, patients can develop focal neurological problems, which is the catch-all term that they will have some odd neuro exam that we do not easily have an explanation for apart from this problem. There you go. They also might have altered mental status, and that could eventually progress to coma, sepsis, and death.
Ah, okay. So yeah, pretty serious. Pretty serious.
Well, just remember that meningitis, while it still is a problem, it is much less common than it previously was, thanks to mass vaccination. Sorry, but not actually remotely sorry to all our conspiracy theory listeners who like to wear tinfoil hats and don't believe in vaccines. Anyway,
I think let's steer clear of the tinfoil hats and let's keep on topic. So as an example, okay, so we've got a university student, they come into ED and the triage board says, query, meningitis. How should we investigate this patient?
So as always, let's structure this via bedside bloods and imaging. At the bedside, it's all about examining the patient, obviously, and a good history. Given patients with bacterial meningitis often present with meningitis and sepsis, an A2E really is important here. In particular, their GCS might be reduced, which can lead to airway issues, which would need to be identified early and rectified early. Establishing any focal neurological deficit or rash is critical here, so a proper neuro exam, rather than just saying they move all four of their limbs, and proper exposure, looking for that rash anywhere in particular. This is the kind of disease where your so-called eyeballing of a patient is also really important, in my opinion. For example, if they say they have a stiff neck and photophobia, but are actually sat in a brightly lit room in ED with their neck bent forward, checking their Instagram, you might actually think that not necessarily true, or that might discourage you slightly from the true meningism features.
Okay, and any other sort of more specific signs to look for otherwise?
Yeah, so old textbooks will mention two things, really. They'll mention Koenig's and Brzezinski's signs, which I'm probably pronouncing horrendously wrong. But anyway, I'll put some links to these in the description, showing how to do each of these tests, because it's probably easier to see than for me to describe it in terms of flexion and extension. The key idea here is that they are movement tests, which aim to stretch the meninges and overall are probably worth doing. The reason I say that is because research shows generally they have a poor sensitivity, somewhere probably around like 5%. So they're not a good way of ruling out meningitis, but they are somewhere between 75% and 95% specific. Meaning if they do have these signs, you have some reasonable evidence clinically to say they have meningitis on examination. An insignificant detail that's helpful to know as well is that they do not correlate to severity, just the diagnosis itself. That makes some sense when you remember severe meningitis can cause coma and paralysis, which might kind of make it difficult to really identify Koenig's and Brzezinski's.
Okay, got it. So definitely eyeball the patient. Are they unwell? Do they have any rash or neurological signs? Make sure you do your A to E and think about trying to do Koenig's and Brzezinski's signs as well.
And crucially, perhaps giving them giving credence to Amir Sam's endless request that we start every exam by looking at patients' hands, are they peripherally shut down?
Got it. So bedside done, what about bloods and imaging?
So firstly, all your normal routine bloods, FBC, using the CRP, given that they are acutely unwell and possibly septic. A blood gas, which tells you the lactate, and the blood glucose are also going to be important. For the exact same reason, a blood culture is critical. And potentially as well, if you're looking at pneumococcal, you could also do a urinary pneumococcal antigen test. Ultimately though, given this is not necessarily a problem with the peripheral blood or even the urine, but an infection around the brain, the blood is arguably the wrong bodily fluid to be looking at. Instead, CSF obtained via lumbar puncture is what's going to confirm your clinical diagnosis. But before we do a lumbar puncture though, we need to make sure this is safe. Why?
Well, I mean, I guess a lumbar puncture, like any procedure, it's going to carry risks. Something like raised intracranial pressure, low platelets, abnormal clotting, they can contraindicate an LP because of the risk of coning. So in an LP, that's where the CSF rushes out, leaving space by which the virtue of the skull being, basically a closed pressurized box has to be filled by the brain, right?
Exactly. So coning, technically caused by our stupidly named tonsillar herniation, which is where the brainstem gets pulled down through the foramen magnum, which causes compression and loss of function and potential brainstem death. Obviously, that's bad. So how do we make sure it's safe to do an LP? It's safe to do an LP without a CT head in patients presenting to hospital with symptoms of meningitis if they are of the following. They have no focal neurological signs. They have no evidence of papilledema edema. They have no seizures, and their GCS is above 12. That's what guidelines will tell you. Now, realistically, I don't think you need to know that off by heart as a third year, but I think it's just useful to know. On the other hand, we should consider delaying LP if the patient has evidence of severe sepsis or rapidly spreading rash, respiratory or cardiac compromise, an infection at a lumbar puncture site like a pressure ulcer — that's a classic you'd never think would actually be important, but really is — or a coagulopathy. So what I'm trying to say here is there are reasons why we might want to delay on doing an LP, and a big reason for that is sepsis, general unwellness, which can definitely happen in meningitis.
So just to recap, it is safe to do a lumbar puncture if there is no focal neurology, no papilledema, no seizures, and a GCS is above 12. And there's a few other sort of more relative contraindications to learn as well. But in summary, if there are no signs of this raised intracranial pressure, we can safely just do an LP without brain imaging, right?
Yeah.
But what about if they do have signs of raised intracranial pressure?
Then, well, I kind of already let the hat out of the bag earlier, but imaging is the essential thing to do in between. LP may still be safe, but you need to do a CT head to make sure there's no midline shift on the scan.
Indeed. So to summarise, bloods, including culture and gas, CT head, and potentially an LP.
You're going to ask me about all the findings on an LP, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
No, I just say a battled no. No way. I'll be honest, it's a big table. I could never for the life of me remember that table when I was in third year, and I couldn't really remember it easily in final year. So I feel like this is a learning thing for all of us. I feel like CSF interpretation, which includes microscopy, PCR and culture, is a topic all by itself and perhaps something we could do another day. So watch this space.
As long as I'm not doing that episode, Harry, that is completely fine with me. But
yeah, I think I have to volunteer.
Yeah, I think you need to take that one on. But yeah, we all do need to know it, and trust me, it comes up in postgraduate exams as well. It's still not fun then. So
right, okay, so let's save everyone some pain and let me give you the bottom line. One, CSF helps you diagnose not only if it is meningitis, but what kind of meningitis it is, aka viral, bacterial, TB and fungal. They all have slightly different classical findings in CSF, which is why I went on and on about them earlier. The other thing to say is CSF testing is getting faster. Have you heard of BioFire, Sally?
So, no, I have not, but I feel like you're going to tell me about it anyway.
Oh, I am. I think it's awesome. So, dear listening, please stay strong and tolerate this pointless tangent. So, BioFire is a trademark for a weird type of rapid diagnostic testing that's recently started to appear in the NHS. It's based on PCR, polymerase chain reaction, and it's a point of care test that you can do in a few hours on things like sputum, blood, and CSF. So it can come back positive for an exact organism in a much faster time frame and allow you to get on with starting some more targeted therapy. But it won't give you true sensitivities like a culture would.
So basically, BioFire is a new rapid point of care test that you think is super exciting. I'm just gonna cut your speech short now on the basis that, let's just say, a university student has had a positive BioFire, come back from a CSF sample. So now what do we do, Harry? What do we do next?
Fine, okay, so as always, it's conservative medical and surgical management, but I'm not going to lie, there isn't really a surgical option for meningitis, so it's just conservative and medical management. Conservatively, we should cover the stuff that everyone forgets at first. Remember that meningitis is a notifiable disease which needs contact tracing, okay? High-risk close contacts, which can actually include health professionals, sometimes need prophylactic antibiotics or potentially a vaccination. From a medical point of view then, the initial medical management depends on actually where you are and where the patient is. And that's whether you're in hospital or in the community. So GPs and paramedics who are suspicious of bacterial meningitis in a patient with a non-blanching rash should specifically give IM or IV Benpen, aka benzyl penicillin. If there's no rash, they can just send them straight to hospital. But because remember we said it's a late sign, if you do see it, you need to crack on and give the medication. Bacterial meningitis warrants immediate hospital admission and discussion with ICU potentially. It's better to get them early rather than later. This is one of the rare cases where a proper culture, i.e. doing an LP, shouldn't actually really delay giving the treatment. Empirical treatment might vary or truss, but everywhere I've worked with, anyway, it's IV ceftriaxone. However, we add an amoxicillin when the patient is immunosuppressed, or older than 60, or pregnant. And can you remember why we'd add in amox when it's so much weaker in our mind than ceftriaxone?
Yeah, I've actually had a patient this week that we gave also amoxicillin for because of the risk of listeria meningitis.
Yeah, exactly. That's cool. I hope they didn't have it.
I'll tell you later.
So for some reason, listeria tends to be sensitive to amoxicillin, which is a drug handed out like Smarties, but it's resistant to bigger, what I think of as stronger siblings like ceftriaxone. Another drug that you might give is a steroid. So meningitis is inflammation and steroids reduce inflammation. Finally, the last piece of like additional cover you are concerned with is about encephalitis. So encephalitis is inflammation of the brain itself rather than just the meninges around it. And it's mainly caused by viruses. So viral meningitis is patients with meningism but without an altered level in consciousness. They're not drowsy, they're not comatose, they're not confused, and they're not seizing. So they don't require antivirals. Meanwhile, patients with meningism and altered consciousness and any of those problems that I just said, they would require treatment for potential encephalitis alongside treatment for bacterial meningitis whilst we're getting more information. So, given that the most common infectious cause of encephalitis is herpes simplex, HSV, if patients have an altered consciousness level, we would give them IV acyclovir. And that's, to be honest, because the only antiviral I ever really heard of at medical school outside of HIV treatment was acyclovir, and that's because it helps treat HSV.
So just to shorten that, yeah, I feel like encephalitis is another really big topic, isn't it? But admit, escalate, IV antibiotics with possibly steroids and possibly antivirals, depending on presentation and CSF results, etc., etc.
Absolutely. And so finally, we're coming into potential complications of meningitis, a lot of which we've already covered. This depends on the organism and encapsulates a few random factoids that might come up in some really rude sections of multiple choice exams. So, yeah, I know, right? But we've got to cover this. So viral/aseptic meningitis, which is the other phrase you might hear it as, is the most common type in the UK, and it generally has the best prognosis. It's generally considered a self-limiting illness. TB meningitis may cause a brain abscess, which can be fatal. These take time to form, which makes sense because TB is often a slow-growing organism, which is why the cultures can take like 6 weeks to show any growth. And for reference, generally leads to a prolonged onset of meningitis. So they're thinking about it in terms of weeks rather than hours. Cryptococcal, aka fungal meningitis, can cause cryptococcomas, small walled-off bundles of infection of cryptococcus. And fungal meningitis is typically only really found in severely immunocompromised patients. Finally, and I say this is the one actually worth remembering, bacterial meningitis can cause sepsis/septicemia. This is mainly in reference to meningococcal meningitis. So sepsis in general messes with clotting in a complicated way. So the problem here is that an LP incurs a risk of bleeding, which is made worse in this sort of case because you've got this impaired clotting effect. So performing an LP in cases of likely sepsis secondary to meningitis is contraindicated. And I kind of mentioned that earlier, but I just wanted to re-emphasize it as a key point in your head.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. It's good to like circle back. So to think about like summarizing the complications, we've got viral, generally self-limiting, TB, slow onset, maybe a brain abscess, fungal causes cryptococcomas, and then sepsis causes a coagulopathy, which means you can't do an LP in these patients.
Or at least you don't want to crack straight into it, you might want to delay it. And that's sure. All correct, so well done. And with that, I think we can go lie down and cry, because that's all I wanted to cover today.
Excellent. Okay. Thanks so much, guys, for listening.
Hello, this is Yvonne with your summary. Meningitis is an inflammation of the meninges, which is typically infective in origin. Meningism is a child of headache, neck stiffness, and photophobia. Viruses are the most common cause of meningitis, producing a less severe illness of fever and meningism. Bacterial meningitis tends to cause fevers, vomiting, meningism, and a progressive non-blanching rash. The most common bacterial causes in the UK are strep pneumonia and severe meningitis. Pneumococcal disease is often seen with coexisting pneumonia. Meningococcal disease can present with mainly septic features or meningism or both. TB meningitis and fungal, mainly cryptococcal meningitis, tend to present over a long period of time. Meningism can happen in any age. It's more common in younger populations, but more severe in older populations. Bedside examination should include an A to E assessment, with particular attention to finding any focal neurological signs, decreased GCS, or rash. Kernig's and Brodsky sign are suggestive of meningitis. Blood tests should include cultures and a gas. The clinical diagnosis can be performed via lumbar puncture. A CT head is often needed before a lumbar puncture. Treatment in the community for those with a non-blanching arch is IM or IV benzyl penicillin. In hospital, IV ceftriaxone is a mainstay of treatment. Amoxicillin is also given to cover for Listeria meningitis in some patient groups. Patients with meningism and older consciousness levels need treatment coverage for encephalitis until a diagnosis is confirmed. Encephalitis is treated using antivirals such as IV acyclovir.